Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Genesis 5 is where we're starting tonight. And then hopefully we'll make it all the way, and I think we will, into the early parts of Genesis 6. That is going to force us to bump into one of the more controversial passages in the early going in Genesis. And so in order to be able to address this next section, I just have to make some explanatory comments that I hope are going to help us kind of get the proper mindset for reading this section of the book of Genesis. First off, basic rule. When you're reading ancient literature, you can't, or at least you shouldn't, it's very difficult not to, but we should not read ancient literature through the lens or mindset of 20th century mores or societal ideas. You have to try as best you can to understand ancient literature within the context of the time and place in which it was written. Let me give you an example. A common complaint against the Bible, whenever anybody wants to write a I don't like the Bible type book, at some point they will point out things like, well, the Bible advocates slavery. And it's not that the Bible advocates it, it's that it was a reality during the time that the Bible was written, and so the Bible addresses it as a reality. Now, in some of Paul's writing, he does write, because of his anticipation that the Lord would be back soon, he does say, if you're a bondservant, which we have to understand is different than our concept of modern American slavery, and you have to understand that oftentimes a bond slave was somebody who put themselves in that situation through borrowing and borrowing and living in a way they couldn't afford until the person who they owed all that money to put them to work for them, and they had to work off that money. That was a bond slave. So yes, sometimes they were people of other countries or nationalities, people who had been conquered and then were put into bondage, like the Israelites in their bondage in Assyria or Babylon or those kind of things. Those were forced kinds of bond slavery. And so when Paul talked about bond slaves within Middle Eastern society during Jesus' time 2,000 years ago, at one point he does say, if you're a master, stay a master. If you're a bond slave, stay a bond slave. If you're married, stay married. If you're unmarried, stay unmarried. And I don't see a direct correlation between those. Nobody enjoyed that. See, I was by myself. Okay. That is not Paul advocating slavery. It was him saying, if you are at this moment a slave, then look toward Christ and continue to live out your Christianity in whatever position or situation you find yourself in. And so it is wrong for us to take modern ideas of slavery as it existed in America in the last 200 years and impose those concepts of slavery on ancient concepts of slavery, and then say the Bible is somehow bad or wrong because it mentions the reality of slavery. Do you understand what I'm saying? People who want to argue against Reformed theology will talk about the Reformers and try to find something unlikable about the Reformers. Like they'll say, well, John Calvin participated in the burning of Servetus at the stake. But what you have to understand about John Calvin and the time he lived in, the society he lived in, was that heretics were summarily captured and tortured for being heretics. He didn't do anything that was dramatically different than the last 1,000 years of the way the church had operated. People get upset about Calvin sometimes and say, well, he didn't stop the use of the state to coerce people into the church. Well, yeah, he was a sacralist. He believed in using the power of the state to coerce people into the church. That's the way it had been for 1,000 years. So in his lifetime, in one man's lifetime, he managed to get a phenomenal amount of theology right and get a phenomenal amount of biblical theology turned around during a time when the Bible wasn't even in the hands of common folk who didn't read to begin with and where the power of the state and the church was all against everything he was doing. So now are you going to blame him for not getting everything right? Well, that's the way that people try to argue against the Reformers, is to say, well, Calvin didn't get everything right, and they'll point out those couple things he didn't get right and say, well, see, he's so clearly wrong. But they do it by saying 20th century mores are this, and he doesn't align with 20th century mores, therefore he's wrong. But he did align with the culture and the mores of the time in which he lived. Do you understand that difference? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when we're looking at early Genesis stuff, there's about to be a passage we're going to read that's caused all sorts of consternation about demonic beings, fallen angels, cohabitating with human women. But the point is, we don't have a problem when we're reading 1 and 2 Samuel or we're reading about David fighting a giant. We'll teach our children that. David slew Goliath. Little David with his sling took down a giant. Now, in the early part of Genesis, we're going to read that giants were produced, Nephilim, as the offspring of this illicit union between fallen angels and human women. And people work very hard to find their way around that passage. So I'm going to try very hard tonight to read that passage through the lens of the time and the place and the culture in which it was written. We're going to go back and look at some other ancient documents that are a commentary on that passage. And we're going to try to not read it through 20th century eyes. Make sense? Because if you read it through 20th century eyes, you go, well, here, I'll give you another example. I listened to a debate this week between William Lane Craig and an admitted atheist from New Zealand. Ostensibly, the debate was about the reality of Christ's resurrection, but it very quickly became about the existence of God. And William Lane Craig, in his opening statement, lays out all of this evidence for the reality and the historicity of Christ and his death and his resurrection and the onset of the Christian church. And he just lays out this preponderance of evidence. And he gets done, and the atheist's argument consists of, well, your evidence means nothing to me because I don't believe it. And since I don't believe your evidence is not convincing. And I don't believe your evidence because your evidence assumes miracles. And in my lifetime, in my observation of the way the world works, I've never seen genuinely miraculous things. I've never seen somebody rise from the dead. And since I, nor my father or my grandfather, have ever seen anybody raised from the dead, then miraculous things don't happen. And since miraculous things don't happen, then they couldn't have happened when Jesus supposedly raised from the dead. So there has to be some other explanation for all of this evidence you're trying to lay in front of us. What did he do? He took 2,000-year-old information, which is more historically attested to than just about any other historic event. And he said, I don't buy it because my observation 2,000 years later is that that doesn't happen. So he took historic information and read it through the lens of what he personally could observe in 20th century mindset. You getting where I'm going here? Understand? Okay. So when we read Moses writing about early fall of man and early fallen angels and the cohabitation between the two of them, we have to say, well, what was Moses trying to tell us? What did Moses believe about this? And importantly, what did the early readers and interpreters of Moses think about this? Not what does the guy who wrote a book last week think about it? I'm more interested in knowing what has the historic understanding of this passage been. You know, I've said many, many times that the closer we can get to the original sources, the closer we get to the truth. That's why I like reading the church fathers. The closer you can get to the people who actually walked and talked with the apostles, the closer you're going to get to what the apostles actually believed about what they wrote. And so that's why I'm constantly digging through historic sources to try to get the meaning of things. Okay, so that was all introduction. So let's start at chapter 5. We kind of touched on this last week. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God he made him. Male and female created he them, and blessed them, and called their name collectively Adam, which means man. In the day when they were created, and Adam lived 130 years, and begat a son in his own likeness, after his image, and called him Seth. I stressed to you last week the big difference between Genesis 1 and 2 and the account of man being made, Adam being made specifically in God's image. Moses is very careful now as he develops his theology to point out that Seth was born in Adam's likeness and image. And so all mankind ever since have been born in Adam's likeness and image. We share in Adam's fallen state. We share in his sinfulness. Paul's proof of that is all men die. And because all men get sick and die, it is proof that we are all Adam's offspring, born after Adam's image and likeness. Got that?
So we can say that man is not any longer made in God's image?
He has made an obvious contrast here. And he didn't say it once, he said it twice, which is a form of emphatic writing. That he said, Adam lived 130 years and he begat a son in his own likeness after his own image. And so he's trying to tell us something important, which is that Seth was not born the way Adam was created. Adam was created in God's image and likeness. And remember when we got to that and I said, okay, well then what does that mean? In God's image, what does that mean? Does it mean that God is 6 foot tall and blue-eyed and... No, it clearly means he's going to be eternal. Unlike all the other animals here, man was the only one that God breathed into his nostrils and made him a living soul, so that there was this eternality to man that no other creature, no other animal had. And in that way, he was made in God's image. But that image has now been broken through sin, and so Moses takes the time to say, now the offspring of Adam are after Adam's image and likeness. Yes, eternal, but also sinful and dying. Originally, when man was made, he was not dying. But once sin came about, death entered in, and so we are all born after that image and likeness. Verse 4, and the days of Adam, after he had begotten Seth, were 800 years, and he begat sons and daughters. I'm guessing in 800 years, you can knock out a lot of sons and daughters. That's what I'm guessing. The tender phrase there was knock out a lot of sons and daughters, yes. And all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. And Seth lived 105 years, and he begat Enos. And Seth lived after he begat Enos 807 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. So if these people start having children in their first 100 years of life, and then live 800, 900 years, and if there's a new generation of kids coming along every 50, 60 years or so, as you're going to see, the ages keep coming down here, then a man could live to see his great, 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 great grandchildren. You could live for a long time and see the lineage of your posterity, but with each new generation of multiple kids, they're all having multiple kids and they're having multiples, and suddenly you're talking about a whole lot of people in a very short time. All the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. And Enos lived 90 years, and he begot Canaan. And Enos lived, after he begot Canaan, 815 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Enos were 905 years, and he died. And Canaan lived 70 years, and begat Mahalalel. Did I say that right? Did I come close?
Mahalalel.
Mahalalel?
Mahalalel.
Yeah, it's close enough for me. Mahalalel? Okay. And Canaan lived after he begat that guy 840 years and begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Canaan were 910 years and he died. And Mahalalel lived 60 and 5 years and he begat Jared. And Mahalalel lived after he begat Jared 830 years and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years, and he died. And Jared lived 162 years, and he begat Enoch. Now the name Enoch, this is going to come up a lot tonight. The name Enoch means disciple, a learner, someone under a discipline, an initiate, something like that. He begat Enoch. Now Jared lived after he begat Enoch 800 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Jared were 960 and 2 years, and he died. And Enoch lived 65 years, and he begat Methuselah. And Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Enoch were 365 years, which is just an interesting number, considering that they were on a lunar calendar, that they would get the number of days of a year exactly right at that moment. And then, unlike each of these other people, I'll get to you in one second, all Moses has told us about each of these people is they lived this long, had sons and daughters, lived this long, and died. Lived this long, sons and daughters, this long, died. This long, sons and daughters, this long, died. And then in speaking of Enoch, he adds verse 24, and Enoch walked with God. That's a distinction. That's something he's trying to tell us. Enoch walked with God in a way that these previous generations didn't seem to do. Enoch had something peculiar about him, and then he said, and he was not, for God took him. So instead of saying he lived 900 and something years and then he died, he said he lived 365 years and then simply wasn't, and God took him. What does that mean? Well, it's picked up in the New Testament, and we'll get to that in a moment. Karen, you had your hand up?
Is there anything revealed to us by these people's names? I mean, you have Canaan, you have all these people.
It's very, very interesting that you would ask that question, because I actually have my little scratched hand notes next to each of these names about these different names. And there was an article I read many years ago by a Jewish writer who pointed out that as these names go down the line, Seth means essentially substituted or put or placed, because he was put in the place of the child who was killed, and then Cain was driven away, Abel was dead, and so there's this substituted child. And the next one you hear is the name Enos, which means mortal, essentially, one that will die, not one that's going to live forever. And Canaan means fixed. And yes, Mahalalel actually means praise of God. Jared means a descendant, basically. And then Enoch means an initiate or a disciple or someone under a discipline. And so if you put those first seven names together, according to this Jewish writer, he was actually saying that God was preaching via these names, because he started out with man, Adam, and that man needed a substitute, which is what Seth means. Seth then needed a mortal substitute, because that's what Enos means. It was a fixed substitute. It was something that was going to happen. It was predestined. It was set. This was going to happen. And that it was going to happen according to the praise of God, which is Mahalalel, or that he, the substitute, the fixed substitute, would be to the praise of God. And the last word is a descent, that he would descend into the earth. And that, of course, then, after he descended into the earth, that Enoch, the disciple, would rise up into the sky because God took him. So it's very interesting you ask that question, because as I was reading through here, I saw my little chicken scratching notes as I went. That goes back 15 years probably to when I read that article and thought that was just fascinating. So, interesting you would ask that. Methuselah means, now Methuselah is after Enoch, but Methuselah means when he dies, it comes. Or when he dies, it happens. The interesting part of that is Methuselah lived longer than any man in history. We all know. You say the name Methuselah, we're talking about the guy who lived longest. Well, the guy who lived longest, his name was, when he dies, the flood comes. This flood that's been promised, the destruction of all mankind, will happen when this guy dies. So again, you see the long suffering of God, that the man who lived longest was the man who was ticking off the time when God would finally destroy the world. So even his name, again, preaches God's patience and long suffering. It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's miraculous.
Almost like there was a God behind it. Mm. Yes. Mm. It's one of those strokey beard things. It's one of those. And Enoch lived 65 years and he begat Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he begat Methuselah 300 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and all the days of Enoch were 365 years. I got into a debate, not a formal debate, a discussion slash argument with a preacher out in Franklin once who was a preteristic fellow, at very least post-millennial, leaning toward preteristic. And one of the first things he said to me was, well, Jim, you know, the problem with your theology is you believe in a rapture, and you can't find a rapture anywhere in the Bible. And I was stunned. I was stymied. I was flabbergasted. I was hornswoggled. I looked at him and said, Me, I can't find a rapture in the Bible. I'm sure that what he meant was, if I went to 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, he was going to challenge me on the interpretation of that stuff. I took him here. I took him to the seventh from Adam. Seven, the number of completion. And that the seventh from Adam was taken up. And that he was not because God took him. I'm sorry, but that is the very definition of a rapture. And I said, I don't have to get more than five chapters into the book of Genesis before people start getting plucked right up off the planet. It's not hard to find a rapture. Turn to Hebrews 11:5 for a second. Hebrews 11 is classically called the heroes of faith passage. And in the list of heroes of faith, the writer of Hebrews mentions Enoch. And he says, verse 4, by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he, being dead, yet speaketh. By faith Enoch was translated. What do your other translations have there for translated?
Taken from this life.
By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death. Now that's really, really clear. So now we've got a New Testament writer commenting, telling us about Enoch and what happened to Enoch. So there's no question from a New Testament perspective what happened to Enoch. Enoch was instantaneously changed, translated that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. And of course, that's the jumping off point at which he writes, for without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. So the New Testament commentary is that Enoch, just like we saw here, walked and talked with God, so he had that testimony that he pleased God, and then he was translated that he would not see death. So we know that Enoch did not die. He was just taken off the planet. And that means a lot of things to me. Number one, it means God can do that. He's been doing it for a long time. If he wants to just take somebody off the planet so that they don't see death, he can do that. Well, in 1 Corinthians, we read Paul writing, 1 Corinthians, is it 1 Corinthians 15? Thank you. He writes, behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all die, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the sound of the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound. This mortal will put on immortality. This corruptible will put on incorruption. Instantaneous change so that we won't see death. Well, where would Paul get such an idea? Where would Paul get this notion of instantaneous change from life to life where you would not see corruption and not die? Genesis 5, God's been doing this for a long time. So I have no problem at all when I bump into those passages that say that God is going to pluck people up off the planet. The word that is used, the word that Paul employs, harpazo, that is translated catching away, and all it means, harpazo, actually means to take something from somebody by force. It was a word used when a robber would descend on you and take your goods. That was to harpazo, to snatch away. And it always had the implication that the one who was doing the taking was the actor. And the thing that was taken was acted upon. And so if I do that, the paper did nothing. The paper was acted upon. It was passive. I harpazoed the paper. Got the picture? That's the word Paul chose to use to say that we who are alive and remain to the coming of Christ will be caught away. Instantaneously changed, harpazoed, to rise and meet the Lord with the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. And then he writes to the Thessalonians, comfort one another with these words. Well, by the time I put together his writing in Corinthians, and his writing in Thessalonians, and the writing in Hebrews, and Genesis 5, I have no problem developing a pretty firm rapture theology that says God not only can pluck people off the planet, but has in the past, and has said he's going to do it again. So I have no qualm with the idea of him plucking people off the planet if he wants to, right? And so Enoch walked and talked with God and was not, for God took him. Methuselah, verse 25, Methuselah lived 180 years, 180 and 7 years, so 187, and he begat Lamech. And Methuselah lived after he begat Lamech for 782 years, and he begat sons and daughters. All the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. So if you're just following the numbers and doing the math, 969 years. The man who lived longest in the Bible. Lamech lived 182 years and begat a son, and he called his son Noah, saying, this same Noah, whose name means essentially comfort, this same Noah will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. So ever since the fall, the ground has been cursed because of sin in the world, and so men are working with the sweat of their brow to try to produce food out of the ground. But the ground itself has been cursed now. And so Noah, in some way, is going to bring some kind of comfort here. And the comfort apparently is, because there's no other comfort to be had in the Noah story, the apparent comfort is the destruction of all the evil people. God's judgment then becomes the comfort that is promised through Noah. And we don't think that way. But we also, again, see, this gets into that 20th century mindset. We should not assume that whenever God does something judgmental, that it's bad. The 20th century mindset, the humanistic mindset that I've been talking about, thinks that anytime something bad happens, that is just intrinsically bad and characteristically bad and always bad. But we've seen God take really bad circumstances and turn them to good. This word compatibilism that we've thrown around a lot. I mean, when Joseph was put into a pit and sold into slavery by his brothers, and the brothers go and tell Dad, Joseph's dead, that's bad. Everything about that's bad. There's no question that that's bad. And yet when Joseph has his brothers standing in front of him, he says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to save many people alive. God accomplished the salvation of the seed, the blessed people, the chosen ones. He accomplished their continuation through this time of drought by sending Joseph on ahead of them, and the way he did it was through really bad circumstances. So you shouldn't always assume that every time you see something bad, that it is intrinsically bad. God in his holiness can do things like judge the whole world and kill everybody and actually have that be good. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, but doesn't that kind of shortchange on the story, because the ark itself is part of the comfort?
Oh, the ark is a great comfort to Noah and his family. And when we get into that and we start looking at the words that are used for the pitch that covers it and God closing the door, oh my goodness, the typology is heavy and thick. And we're going to have to deal with all that. But when you talk about the ground being cursed and you say he will be a comfort because the ground is cursed, in what way can you say that Noah is going to be a comfort to the cursed ground? Yes, the ark is a comfort to Noah, but that's Noah's comfort. The comfort to Lamech and the descendants of these people, the descendants of Seth, who are not the Cainites, who we talked about last week. The seed, the chosen of God, have this comfort of knowing that God is not going to always strive with man, but is at some point going to bring about judgment and start over again with Noah and head toward righteousness. While at the same time, you've got this promise hanging out there that someday the seed of the woman is going to destroy the seed of the serpent. So he called his name Noah, saying, this same shall comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. And Lamech lived after he begat Noah 595 years, and he begat sons and daughters. And all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem and Ham and Japheth. There are a couple meanings for the word Shem, for the name Shem. One of them is a form of the word for brown. Ham means hot or warm, but it also means black. It was the color black. And Japheth means expansion, and from all accounts, the European people descended from him. What's interesting is these boys have these different names that mean these different colors. And if you think it through, You've got Noah, his three boys, and their wives, eight people on the ark. And from those eight people come all the different nationalities and people groups on the planet. So there's a Mongol seed in there somewhere. And there's a black African seed in there somewhere. And there's a Middle Eastern dark-skinned seed in there somewhere. And there's a white European seed in there somewhere. And there's been a lot of speculation through the years where, okay, well, if it's Noah and his wife, could they have produced these three different people groups? Or would that have to have been in the marrying? Would they have had to marry particular genetic backgrounds or races? So somewhere in the midst of this language and in the midst of this story, what we know is all the people groups of the earth descend from these eight people, and so that seed of all those different people groups has to be represented somewhere in these eight people. And so it's interesting that the names also are things like black and brown and names that would later be European descent. And that takes us to chapter 6, verse 1. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God, now this is a very particular phrase, sons of God. So now I have to introduce you to another concept. Apocryphal books. All that means is hidden books. And in the Old Testament, around the time of Jesus, there were the books that were considered the canonical books, the books that were read in the synagogue on Saturdays. But there were also books that were bound with the canonical books that were called the hidden books. And if you pick up a Catholic Bible, I have a couple at home, you'll notice that a Catholic Bible does not have 66 books like our standard, what's considered Protestant Bible has. They have a few extra books. They have 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which is really just a history book about Antiochus Epiphanes in the time of Judas Maccabee. But then they also have like Judith and Tobit and a couple of other books that we don't have. Those books were apocryphal books. Those books were books that were often bound with Old Testament books, but weren't considered inspired books, God-breathed books, but still helpful books and historic books. So they kept them as part of Hebrew literature. And so the Catholic Church historically has kept them as part of the Old Testament. Whereas because the Jews themselves and the rabbis themselves didn't consider them to be inspired books, the Protestant history has been to not include them as part of the canon, part of the Bible. A few of those apocryphal books were considered to be quite influential during the time of Jesus. The most influential of those apocryphal books at the time that Jesus was walking and talking was a book that was called Enoch. Now, there's no historic evidence to say that Enoch wrote it. It seems to be about Enoch, and it fell into disfavor in the early years of the church, finally, because it did talk about the fallen angels. It talked about the watchers, and Enoch called them sons of God. And so it's very interesting that Moses also used, in referring to fallen angels here, he uses the phrase sons of God, very Enochian language. Let me show you something that's interesting. Turn over to the book of Jude, a very short book in the New Testament, so short, in fact, that it has no chapters. It only has verses. Turn to Jude, verse 14. I still hear pages flipping. Jude 14, you got it there, Jennifer? You want to read it for us?
Now, Enoch.
I'm sorry, did I wake you?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
And now Enoch 7 from Adam prophesied about these.
Okay, now hold on. Talking about rebels against the church, talking about those who are rebellious against God, he says, and Enoch, the 7th from Adam, so there's no question which Enoch we're talking about. We're talking about the one that walked and talked with God and was not because God took him. Enoch, the 7th from Adam, prophesied. And now he's going to quote a prophecy of Enoch. That's how much influence the book of Enoch had on the first century church. And this is Jude, the brother of Jesus, writing. And so he prophesied what?
Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints.
And so that is a prophecy. Jude is saying that judgment is going to come and that Enoch himself, an ancient book, prophesied that the Lord was going to come with the 10,000s of his saints. So my point is this. I'm not arguing that Enoch should be included in the canon. I'm not saying that the book of Enoch is inspired directly of God. What I am saying for a fact, historically, is that the book of Enoch was very well known during the time of Jesus. It was quoted by Jude. And by the way, there were several copies of Enoch found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, bound with other Old Testament books. And so it was a very well-known, popularly published document. That's all I'm getting at. Now, as we read here in Genesis 6, it says that the sons of God, an Enochian phrase, saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, and yet his days shall be 120 years. So now you see God saying they've been living 800, 900 years. They do evil their whole life. So from here forward, I'm going to knock them back to 120 years. Well, how does he do that? He's going to have to change the physical structure of the earth so that men can't live on it as long. And he's going to do that by destroying the canopy. And so, let's see, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days. Moses just puts that out there. There were giants in the earth in those days. And you go, well, where did the giants come from? Enoch, which I'm going to read for you in a moment, gives us much more detail, commentary, about this section of Genesis. And he's going to say that the giants, the Nephilim, were the direct offspring of this cohabitation between fallen angels and women. And that the reason for the flood was to destroy these hybrids. There were giants in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men and they bore children to them, these also became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. What an odd phrase. You've got these hybrid creatures who are getting information from fallen angels, and that information they're getting from fallen angels makes them superior to regular human beings. And so, of course, they would become men of renown. Now, the very common modern 20th century interpretation of this passage is that sons of God means descendants of Seth. We're talking about the godly lineage as opposed to the Cainite lineage. And that somehow the sons of God, the Seth descendants, saw that the daughters of the Cainites were fair, and so they intermarried among the Cainites and the Seth line. And that they produced men who became leaders in their community, and that's what it means by giants. I'm not kidding you, that is the common interpretation. That's most of the modern books being written. That's why I started tonight by saying, you have to read it through the eyes of the people who originally wrote it. What did they think it meant? It's just too easy to interpret this through a 20th century mindset and say, well, but there couldn't be. That couldn't happen. How could fallen angels cohabitate with women and produce giants? How could that happen? But like I said, we have no problem with David and Goliath. No, giant. Kill the giant with a sling. We're okay with that. But giants as a direct result of fallen angels, well, if you can wrap your mind for a moment around the idea of fallen angels cohabitating with women and producing a hybrid, you know, race of giants, then you can see why God would go, time to wipe everybody out. We got to put a stop to this right away. I'm going to take 8 people and start again, and I'm going to take those fallen angels and I'm going to tuck them away down here where they can't get out anymore for the evil that they've done. God saw, verse 5, look at verse 5 here, for anybody who wants to argue with the whole total depravity concept. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. At this point, human beings, after the fall and now the corruption of the Nephilim, everything combined, when God looked down on the planet, all he saw was only evil continually. That's the state of man since the fall. That's the way God views mankind since the fall. At what point, if you're going to argue against the idea of total depravity, at which point since then did men get good? Because nowhere in the Bible does it say goodness happened. Instead, what you see is that among all humanity, Paul picks it up in the New Testament and says we're born dead in our trespasses and sins. So this is a constant theme throughout the Bible that human beings are not intrinsically good, and therefore if anybody is going to get into God's presence, it has to be because God did something for them. It can't be something they did because all they did was only evil continually. And so if anybody ends up in God's presence, it has to be because God himself said, I'm going to bring you to myself. And I am going to give you an alien righteousness, a righteousness that is not your own. I am going to give you a righteousness that my son has, and I'm going to impute it to you because you are incapable of being righteous. And so all of that theology that we continue to propound that, you know, is all the way through the Bible finds its basis right here. Mankind, after the fall, was only evil continually. And you have to use that as your starting point when you develop any kind of soteriology. Any kind of theology of salvation has to take into account that man is only evil continually and that he's born dead in trespasses and sins. That's the starting place for man. Then whatever other theology you develop, you got to take that into account. So if you take those dead in trespasses and sins, only evil continually people, and you tell them, now you got to do something good, you got a problem because they can't because they're evil and they're dead. So the theology has to be, God must move. God must do something for you. Or you end up exactly like the whole world ended up. Does that seem wrong to you that God killed everybody? He just wiped out everybody. I mean, completely indiscriminately took out everybody except eight people. Eight people. And by the way, we're going to read in a moment, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Well, yeah. It doesn't say Noah was a good guy and so God. Noah found grace. Right away, Moses puts that theology right in there. And oh, yeah, grace, because he's the only one that didn't die. And so much grace that he even took his three sons and, you know, the wives. And those eight people repopulated the earth. That's nothing but grace. And if you want to argue, well, no, it's because they were really good people. Ham's going to end up under the curse. And Noah gets off the boat and plants a vineyard and gets drunk. And ends up drunk and naked. So it's really hard to argue that he was just so good that God had to save him. No, he got saved because he was under God's grace. There's no other way to read it. So let's take a moment out right here at this stopping point. Mankind was only evil continually. And let me read a little bit of Enoch to you. Because now Enoch is going to expand on that little blurb that we just read out of Genesis. This is chapter 6. Now I have to tell you, by the way, if you go online and you start looking for the book of Enoch, there's different versions because there are later Gnostic versions that are assigned the name Enoch and stuff. That's not what you're looking for. This is the Ethiopian Enoch text. It's also called Enoch 1. And this is the one that is actually found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So don't just take anything you find online that says Enoch and go, well, this is what Jim was reading from. No, no, no. I'm reading from the one that has historic proof that it dates all the way back to pre-first century. This is the one that, by the way, is quoted exactly in the book of Jude. It came to pass that when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw and lusted after them and said to one another, come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men, and we will beget us children. And Semyaza, who was their leader, said unto them, I fear you will not indeed agree to do this deed, and that I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin. And they all answered him and said, let us all swear an oath, and all bind ourselves by mutual imprecations, not to abandon this plan, but to do this thing. Then swear they all together and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And they were in all 200. Who descended in the days of Jared on the summit of Mount Hermon, and they called it Mount Hermon because they had sworn and bound themselves by mutual imprecations upon it. And these are the names of their leaders: Semiazes, their leader, Arakabah, I don't know about these names, I'm going to do my best here, Ramiel, Kokabiel, Tamalel. Notice they've all got that El name at the end, that God name at the end, just like Michael or Gabriel. Yeah. Ramiel, Danel, Ezekiel, and several other guys whose names end in L.
Does he name all 200?
No, he names, these are the chiefs of tens. And so he names 20 of them, each of whom was a chief over 10.
Let's just say this is true, for argument's sake. Would this be among the one-third of fallen agents?
Has to be.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure, there's more than 200. I don't know.
No, but these are the 200 who did this. Yeah, if you were going to say this was somehow all of the fallen angels, then all of the fallen angels were put away by God so that they couldn't affect mankind anymore. And certainly we have to say there are plenty of demons running around busy these days. So we're talking about one segment of fallen angels here. Chapter 7. And all the others together with them took unto themselves wives, and each chose for himself one. And they began to go in unto them and to defile themselves with them. And they taught them charms and enchantments and the cutting of roots, which would be the way to make mixtures and witchcraft type stuff, and made them acquainted with plants, and they became pregnant, and they bare great giants, whose height was 3,000 ells, I have no idea how big that would be, who consumed all the acquisitions of men. And when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them and devoured mankind. And they began to sin against birds and beasts and reptiles and fish, and to devour one another's flesh and to drink blood. Then the earth laid accusation against the lawless ones. Chapter 8. And Azazel taught men to make swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working them, and bracelets and ornaments and the use of antimony and the beautifying of the eyelids, and all kinds of costly stones, and all the coloring tinctures or paints. And there arose much godlessness, and they committed fornication, and they were led astray, and they became corrupt in all their ways. Semyaza taught enchantments and root cuttings. Armaros taught the resolving of enchantments. Barakael taught astrology. Kokabel taught the constellations. Ezekiel taught the knowledge of the clouds. Erechiel, the signs of the earth. Shamsael, the signs of the sun. And Sariel, the course of the moon. And as men perished, they cried, and their cry went up into heaven. And then Michael, Uriel, Raphael, and Gabriel looked down from heaven and saw much blood being shed on the earth, and all the lawlessness being wrought upon the earth. And they said to one another, the earth, made without inhabitant, cries the voice of their cryingness up into the gates of heaven. And now to you, the holy ones of heaven, the souls of men make their suit, saying, bring our cause before the Most High. And they said to the Lord of ages, Lord of lords, God of God, King of kings, and God of the ages, the throne of your glory stands unto all generations of the ages, and thy name is holy and glorious and blessed unto all ages. You have made all things, and you have power over all things, and all things are naked and open in thy sight, and you see all things, and nothing is hid from you. You see what Azazel has done, who has taught all unrighteousness on the earth, and who has revealed the eternal secrets that were preserved in heaven, which men were striving to learn. I find that really interesting, by the way, because what was the temptation to eat the knowledge of good and evil? It was to gain heavenly knowledge, be like God. And so mankind is getting what they wanted now, but it's the fallen angels that are giving them all this knowledge that was not helpful to them, was not good for them. And Semyaza, to whom you have given authority to bear rule over his associates, and they have gone to the daughters of men upon the earth, and they have slept with the women and have deviled themselves, and have revealed to them all kinds of sins. And the women have borne giants, and the whole earth has thereby been filled with blood and unrighteousness. And now behold, the souls of those who have died are crying and making their suit to the gates of heaven. Their lamentations have ascended and cannot cease because of the lawless deeds which are wrought on the earth. and you know all things before they come to pass, and you see these things, and you do suffer these things. And thou dost not say to us what we are to do in regard to these things. Then said the Most High, the Holy and the Great One spoke, and sent Uriel to the son of Lamech, and said, Go to Noah, and tell him in my name, Hide thyself, and reveal to him the end that is approaching, that the whole earth will be destroyed. And a deluge is about to come upon the whole earth, and will destroy all that is on it. And now instruct him that he may escape, and his seed may be preserved for all generations of the world. And again the Lord said to Raphael, Bind Azazel hand and foot, and cast him into the darkness, and make an opening in the desert, which is in Dudael, and cast him therein, and place upon him rough and jagged rocks, and cover him with darkness, and let him abide there forever, and cover his face, that he may not see light. And on the day of the great judgment he shall be cast into the fire, and heal the earth which the angels have corrupted, and proclaim the healing of the earth, that they may heal the plague, and that all the children of men may not perish through all the secret things that the watchers have disclosed and have taught their sons. And the whole earth has been corrupted through the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin, and to Gabriel said the Lord, Proceed against the bastards and the reprobates and against the children of fornication to destroy the children of fornication and the children of the watchers from among men, and cause them to go forth, and send them one against the other, that they may destroy each other in battle, for length of days they shall not have. And no request that they or their fathers make of thee shall be granted unto their fathers on their behalf, for they hope to live an eternal life, and that each one of them shall live 500 years. And so the Lord said to Michael, Go and bind Samyaza and his associates, who have united themselves with women, so that they have defiled themselves with them in their uncleanness. And when their sons have slain one another, and they have seen the destruction of their beloved ones, then bind them fast for 70 generations in the valleys of the earth, until the day of their judgment and of their consummation, until the judgment that is forever and ever is consummated. And in those days they shall be led off to the abyss of fire, to the torment and to the prison in which they shall be confined forever. And whosoever shall be condemned and destroyed will from thenceforth be bound together with them until the end of all generations, and destroy all the spirits of the reprobate and the children of the watchers, because they have wronged mankind. Destroy all wrong from the face of the earth, and let every evil work come to an end, and let the plant of righteousness and truth appear, and it shall prove a blessing, and works of righteousness and truth shall be planted in truth and joy forevermore. Quite a commentary, huh? Now, here's my point in reading all that, other than to demonstrate my reading skills. That is an ancient commentary on what we just read out of Genesis. And so, what did the early Hebrew mindset think about what was written in Genesis? It thought that when Moses wrote that there were giants in the earth, and the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children, and the same became mighty men of old, men of renown, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, that all of that was literal. However the book of Enoch got to us, however it was passed down, whoever actually originally wrote it, however much influence it had on the first generation so that it was included in the book of Jude, the first century mindset where Genesis 5 was concerned, Genesis 6 is concerned, was that it was to be taken literally. That's all I'm trying to say. And so I take it literally. It makes plenty of sense to me, and it helps me understand the flood. Because I look around at the earth now, and I say, really? If men were so bad that God flooded the whole earth, look now.
Where's Noah?
I'm looking for an ark. If, in fact, God destroyed the whole earth simply because human beings were fallen and sinful, well, human beings are still fallen and sinful. But Genesis and Enoch tell us that something extraordinary happened. That now that mankind had been created, fallen angels cohabitated with women and created this hybrid that had to be destroyed off the earth completely. And so God wiped out mankind and the hybrid creatures and everybody and started over with Noah as an act of grace. And that makes, in many ways, more sense to me. Whereas if you do the more humanistic interpretation of it, that it just means that some good men took on some bad wives and produced some people who became men of renown, then which part of that caused God to destroy the earth?
What's interesting is every time I see a horror movie advertised on TV, it's pretty much the same thing. It's a vampire and a woman. That's what? Some kind of demonic entity, right, and a woman. Yeah. You see this over and over and over, and the mythology, they just won't go away.
Right.
You know, and here you have a very plausible explanation of where mythology even came from.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, has its roots in a real thing. It's mm-hmm. really fascinating. I mean, we can't go around screaming, this has got to be true, but gee, it makes a lot of sense.
Well, I do have to go around screaming that Genesis 6 has to be true.
Absolutely.
If you can show me some part of the Bible that I can't take literally, then I have to change my hermeneutic.
Right.
But my hermeneutic is take the Bible literally.
This entire expanded thing actually makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But we can't swear by it. It makes a lot of sense.
What we can say, though, and this is what I keep driving at, and I'm glad you're saying that. I'm driving at one thing. The only reason I read Enoch tonight, that big passage from it, was not to say this is biblical, God-breathed stuff. I'm not arguing that it should be in the canon. I'm not saying it's the Bible. I'm not saying hang your soul on it. What I'm saying is this was a very influential book that gives us an interpretation, an ancient interpretation of what Genesis 6 is saying. And so why would I prefer a more modern interpretation that causes me to interpret the text of Genesis 6 in an unnatural way?
And Jude himself makes him credible.
Well, in the Hebraic tradition, do they have an idea of when this book of Enoch surfaces?
No.
I'm curious how late even the biggest liberal can make it. It's still got to be...
No, well, the point is it's pre-Christ, and that's why it's important that copies of it were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Every Old Testament book and some extra-canonical books, including Enoch, were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But the point is, it was there. And that means that the Essenes, or whoever it was that actually put the scrolls there, who actually hid them in the cave, found that book to be as important as everything else they put away. There's my point. And so what was the ancient mindset and interpretation of Genesis 6? A very literal interpretation. That's all I'm getting at. And I continue to argue that the proper hermeneutic for understanding the Bible is the literal reading of it. The words on the page make sense, and if the words on the page don't mean what they say, then they can mean anything at all. And what it says in Genesis 6 is sons of men cohabitated with women and created giants. And then people write volumes and volumes to try to avoid that interpretation because that's what the words say. And I'm saying ancient interpretations of it, like Enoch, say no, literally, this is what we're being told actually happened. And so I got to go with that's what actually happened. And even if that doesn't fit my worldview in the 20th century today, it doesn't matter. It wasn't written today. It was written in ancient times, and it has to be understood through that lens. Right?
But isn't that the issue? Is it's rattling the cage of our septic society?
Absolutely. Isn't that the whole Bible? That's my complaint with so much of the way the Bible is handled today. People who say, well, yes, it says right here, I will not have a woman to teach or usurp authority over a man.
Hogwash.
And that's all it takes. And then you run. Exactly. I see consternation in some of you. That was the way that Joyce Meyer handled that text. She actually said, people say, well, Joyce, what about the text where Paul writes that he would not have a woman teach or usurp authority over a man? What do you say to that? I say, hogwash. That's literally what she said. And then she said, God would not have given me this gift to teach if he didn't want me to use it. In other words, God gave her a gift to cause her to act in direct opposition with what he had already said. That makes no sense to me whatsoever, but it is indicative of what happens when you try to read the Bible through a modern, current 20th century mindset. We want equality for women, and since our modern society says equality for women, if the Bible says a woman can't do something, we're going to argue that she can anyway, because that's our modern mindset. And I'm saying you have to understand the Bible through the lens of the original writers and the inspiration that they were under, and understand that those truths haven't changed. If you're going to say that what the original inspired writers wrote has changed, then you have to show me that God changed somewhere. That those rules that God inspired these men to write, God now went, nah, never mind. That doesn't count anymore because society changed. Doesn't matter if society changed. I agree. Society changed. The question is, did God change? And if God didn't change, then there are demons at this moment being held down by the holy watchers, the holy angels, who have put them, bound them, hid them until the judgment. And that means judgment is real and lake of fire is real. The lake of fire is described in the book of Revelation as being prepared for the devil and his angels. Well, yeah. It fits very well. The literal reading of the Bible continues to make one great big cohesive whole. And I don't have to argue that any text doesn't mean what it says.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.